Okay, our text in the book of Acts is going to be the entirety of chapter 25. This is one of those chapters that is a transition between Paul's speeches. So just like last week, history is going to be more prominent than doctrine. This morning we're going to look at the Apostle Paul standing before the new governor of Judea. His name is Festus, and this will be the fourth of Paul's five hearings. Now, you remember that Paul had first been arrested in what was essentially protective custody. He'd been at the temple to be purified as part of sponsoring the vows of a group of observant Jewish Christians. But when pilgrims from Ephesus recognized him, here you have this infamous Paul of Tarsus, they cried out. And they cried out, among other things, that he had violated the sanctity of the temple, which was a falsehood. But in any case, a riot broke out. And so Paul was in the midst of being beaten by the crowd when Roman troops finally reached him and rescued him, and he was taken to the barracks of the fortress Antonia. But then as he reached the top step, he asked that if he could address the crowd, and they let him. And this is his first defense, is essentially a defense, a trial before the Jewish people. And the text tells us that the crowd listened in silence to Paul's testimony of his Judaism and of his conversion. But when he implied that God had turned from the Jews to the Gentiles, of course, the crowd erupted all over again. And for the second time, the Romans saved him, and they pushed him into the safety of the fortress. Now, Claudius Lysias, who is the Roman tribune, the commander, had first mistaken Paul for a recent Egyptian insurrectionist and prophet, but now he had no idea who he was, nor why the crowd had gone into a frenzy. So he's about to interrogate the Apostle Paul with a whip, but at the last minute, Paul revealed his Roman citizenship. And so Claudius then decided to take Paul to the Sanhedrin, because like most troubles that they had with the Jews, all that he really knew was that this uproar involved something about religion. He had no clue as to what. And so he takes him to the Sanhedrin. When Paul was brought before them, he was able to then distract the Pharisees and the Sadducees away from his particular case and over to the question of resurrection. Of course, at the heart of the gospel is the belief in resurrection, specifically in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But resurrection as a doctrine was also one of the bitter differences between Pharisees and Sadducees. And so the debate turned violent, and the Romans entered in to discover Paul at risk of being torn apart, says the text, between the two factions. And so once again, troops had to rescue him, and they returned to Antonia more perplexed than ever. Here, this riot is all about this one man. We bring him to the Sanhedrin, this august body, the Jewish leadership, and he's in there for a few minutes, and all of a sudden another riot breaks out. They can't understand it. But then when Claudius was told of a plot between the Sanhedrin and zealots to murder Paul, he sent him to the governor in Caesarea in the middle of the night, under a strong military escort, and that's where we began last time. Paul was brought to Herod's former palace and brought before the Roman procurator of Judea, which at this time was Marcus Antonius Felix. And so then after reading Claudius's letter concerning the riot and then hearing the charges of the Jews, Felix agreed to preside over the case. And then in a few days, members of the Sanhedrin arrived along with a lawyer who was going to act as the prosecution. And Paul was charged with being a plague upon the Jewish people. He's a pestilence. He's a man who incited unrest wherever he went. He was accused of being a ringleader of these heretical Nazarenes. He had also offended both the law and the temple. And so that was the prosecution's case. But Paul's defense proved how empty those charges were, except, of course, being of the party of the Nazarenes, which he called the Way. But he basically defended himself, saying, look, I couldn't have been this insurrectionist. I just got here. And they knew I just got here. I've been here less than 12 days. And I'd just been purified. And I'd engaged no one at the temple. And those who had accused him of fomenting unrest in Asia were not even present to testify. Therefore, those charges didn't stand water. So Felix clearly agreed with Claudius that Paul had done nothing worthy of punishment, much less the death penalty that was being urged by the Jews. But Felix was also pragmatic, even worse as far as character is concerned, and in his mind, justice was not the highest priority here. Maintaining order, reducing tensions, that was a greater consideration. And so with those thoughts in mind, Felix delayed his verdict. He told both sides that he would wait to hear from Claudius Lysias, the commander, before rendering a judgment. And yet, in 2 years, Claudius was never brought in to be interviewed. So this was just a tactic to stall. Well, for those 2 years, Paul was sequestered in the governor's palace. During that time, he was allowed visitors. And on occasion, the text tells us that he was brought before Felix and his Jewish wife, Drusilla, to discuss religion. Luke says that Paul told Felix and Drusilla of faith in Christ, about righteousness, about self-control, and about judgment. In fact, the conviction was at times so intense that the text tells us here that Felix grew alarmed and had to send Paul away. I'll send for you later. I can't take any more. Now we've come to the end of last week's text. And as we said, Paul was kept in custody for 2 years in Caesarea from the year 57 to 59. In the year 59, tensions broke out into violence again in the city, and Felix responded with crushing brutality, far beyond what was necessary. And then he used the uprising as a pretext for confiscating their property. So finally, Jewish leadership had had enough. They sent a delegation to Rome. They appealed directly to the emperor Nero. And so Felix was recalled, and he was very nearly arrested for official misconduct. Under his misadministration, Judea had degenerated to the brink of chaos. The wilderness was filled with revolutionaries and bandits, and in the cities you had zealots and assassins plotting vengeance. So everything was primed for the great Jewish war that was to come. But as we begin with chapter 25, there is this kind of pause, a brief interval of relatively good government between bad, that is Felix, and what would actually be worse. The new procurator of Judea was Porcius Festus, and he had just arrived in Caesarea. Now, we know very little about Festus. We know that Josephus viewed him as the best of the last governors. He restored a measure of order. He did pursue terrorists relentlessly, but without the disregard for the general population that Felix had shown. We'll talk a little bit more about Festus later. But here, as Luke begins chapter 25, you have Festus, newly arrived at his command in the most difficult province over the most difficult people in all of the empire. And his first order of business was to make an official visit to the Jewish capital and to basically be seen and to see the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem. So verse 1 of chapter 25. It says, "Now 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul. And they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way." Now there's a note in the margin of an early Syriac text that says that these were the same 40 plotters, remember, who had taken the vow, "We're not going to eat." Did they not eat for 2 years? In reality, the truth is that when you had a vow and you couldn't keep it, you would go to the temple, there would be an offering, whatever, and you could get out of that vow. But in any case, it's the same plan as before. Have Paul sent to us, and as he's coming, we're going to ambush it and kill him. And Luke's reference to "they," saying they plan to do this, implicates the Sanhedrin leadership again. They're part of the plot. It's also noteworthy that on the new governor's very first visit, the Jews immediately petitioned him concerning Paul. That's evidence of his importance to them and of the intensity of their hatred. You have a new governor come to the city, meeting them for the very first time, and the first thing they want to say is, "We want you to do something about Paul." But in reply, we get the first glimpse of Festus. And we see that during his administration, he's going to be conciliatory to the Jews. and yet he's going to firmly uphold Roman law. Verse 4. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea, and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So, said he, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. So we see here that Festus politely refused their pleas to transfer Paul to their custody or take him to Jerusalem. It's probably doubtful that he knows all the specifics of the case yet, but he does know who Paul was. He knew that he was a Roman citizen. He knows he's being held in Herod's palace. He's basically telling them, unless they come to Caesarea and bring charges, I have no cause to keep him. And then we take from the next verses that the Jewish interest in Paul had not waned at all, so that you notice that on the governor's return to Caesarea, Paul is the very first order of business, the very next day. And of course, the Jewish leaders have come with him. And all of that is remarkable when you consider that all of the matters that would have needed the attention of a new governor and of his most difficult subjects, this is the very first topic they're going to address, is the Apostle Paul. And so we have verse 6. After he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day, he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense. Now, Luke's account here is more abbreviated than the hearing that he describes under Felix. But it would appear that the Jews had been less than satisfied with the performance of their lawyer. Remember, they brought a professional lawyer down. So this time they opt for less subtlety. Basically, they gather around the Apostle Paul. They angrily accuse him of various crimes. Now, our indication of the charges that were brought by the Jews aren't given here. They come from Paul's response. It would seem that he was accused of violating Jewish law, which is religious law, of violating the sanctity of the temple, and of offending the authority of the emperor. Now, this is the first time that Caesar is mentioned directly. The Jews knew that the governor would not convict Paul on religious grounds. Therefore, they had to spin them in a way to make civil law apply. And so once again, Luke, and of course Providence, is stressing the parallels between Christ and Paul. This was the exact tactic that had forced the hand of Pontius Pilate. The point being that Paul must follow where Christ had led. And so as John Stott quoted another person's comment, the problem throughout all of Paul's trial was this, that the charge was political, and yet the evidence was theological. But the Jews could not make the charge theological because they needed the political conviction to put Paul to death. And that was the Jewish problem the entire time. Now, throughout Paul's defense, it surprises some people to see that Paul had no dispute on principle with the authority of either Rome or Jerusalem. From his letters, he believed both of these exercised a God-given status. We see in the book of Romans, he says very clearly that the authority of Rome, that is, you are to submit to the authority that is above you. And in this case, it is Rome. He says, submit to Rome. Their authority has been given by God. He also stated that the privileges of Israel are also a God-given legacy. But here's the caveat, as observed by John Stott. He said, Rome might misuse her authority, and Jerusalem might misrepresent their law as the means of salvation. In such case, Paul would oppose them. But Paul's contention was that in principle, the gospel supports the rule of Caesar and fulfills the hope of Israel. So he doesn't have a problem with that. So those who think that Paul should have said, I reject your authority, I answer to no king but Christ, they make the same confusion that Pontius Pilate made. And remember, Christ corrected him. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. So as much as it pains me at times because I'm a fallen creature as well, we're called to submit to earthly authority. It's only when such authority demands that we violate our conscience that we can no longer submit. But in this case before the Roman governors, that did not apply for Paul. Nor had he ever been guilty of a civil offense. In fact, in the riots of Asia, Paul had not instigated them. They'd always been in response to what he was saying. They were started by his opponents. And yet, despite all of this, despite the fact that he's clearly not guilty of anything, things took a sudden turn. Now, Festus may have been a better man than Felix, but that did not mean that political choices were not in play. And Paul was clearly alarmed with the direction that this hearing was taking, and we see in verse 9. It says, "But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, 'Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?'" Now, we see that Festus is willing to appease the Jews by moving the venue to Jerusalem. But to his credit, he asked Paul if that's what he wanted. He could have ordered it so without Paul's consent. But you can imagine how that would have ended. You remember the influence of the crowds at the trial of Jesus, screaming to crucify him. And so in verse 10, Paul answers. He says, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." So Paul clearly believes that just because Festus has asked him his preference, that did not mean that Paul's preference was guaranteed in the end. Festus, in the end, may have put more weight in a good relationship with the Jews over Paul's choices. So Paul is likely alarmed that Festus, first of all, had not dismissed the charges, but also the fact that Festus had in his mind the possibility even of transferring him to Jerusalem. And that caused Paul to take recourse in an appeal directly to Caesar. Now, in the days of the Republic, Roman citizens could appeal to the people. That's what it was called. It meant you could bring your case before the Senate. That had evolved into an appeal to Caesar. By Paul's day, few cases were actually heard by the emperor, but all of them would enter into the imperial court system, and that would be the place of final appeal. But you can imagine how the volume of cases meant there had to be some restriction to this, or every criminal out there would be appealing to Caesar. Now, there could be unpleasant consequences if a governor was called into account for not granting the appeal. But really, governors were under no obligation to do it. They only had to answer why they were rejecting it, or even why they were accepting it and clogging up the courts. And so we see in verse 12 that Festus and his advisors go off and they weigh the decision. Verse 12 says, "Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, 'To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go.'" And so in the end, Festus and his council must have viewed Paul's appeal as a godsend, or whatever gods he was thinking at the time. This was the best solution to the case that Festus could have hoped for, because it took the verdict out of his hands, and so he's saved from offending either the Jews on the one hand or Roman law on the other. He had but one difficulty left. That was to put the case into words, because he's obligated to provide the imperial court with the facts of the case and then justification as to why are you deferring judgment here. His problem was, just like Claudius the Tribune and the rest of the Romans around him, Festus really did not understand the religious controversy that's at the heart of everything, meaning that he struggled with explaining why the Jews were seeking Paul's execution in the first place. But he hoped that help was on its way. And we enter into the scene here, Herod Agrippa II. Herod Agrippa II is considered an authority on Judaism, and he was coming to Caesarea to meet the newly installed governor. And we have that in verse 13. Now, when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There's a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him." Now, just as background, Agrippa ruled a small piece of Palestine, which is modern-day Lebanon. But, of course, he was doing it under Roman auspices. He's a vassal king to Caesar. Bernice, who is mentioned here, was his sister. As you remember, Felix's wife, Drusilla, was also Agrippa's sister. Now, Agrippa, as far as history is concerned, was generally appreciated for being an advocate for his people. But at the same time, he was very loyal to Rome. In fact, after the Jewish War, where you have Israel laid waste and the temple is in rubble, Agrippa actually struck a coin in honor of Rome putting down the rebellion. Okay. Now, another footnote to history. I don't even know why I included this, but his sister Bernice became the mistress of Titus, the Roman general who actually destroyed Jerusalem. When Titus became emperor, now he has a consort of these hated Jews, and it became too scandalous, and so he left her. Now, that's beside our story here. That's all the intricacies of royal plotting and all the rest of that stuff. But in truth, Agrippa was the first one to hear Paul, who was both competent in Roman and Jewish law. Therefore, in reality, he was a good source of information to the governor. So Festus presented the specifics of the case to Herod Agrippa, and then the Jews demanded the prisoner's execution, he says. And so in verse 16, this is what he says his answer to that was. He says, "I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive." Of course, there's the heart of the issue, isn't it? It's the heart of redemptive history. It's ironically spoken by an unbeliever that Jesus was dead, but Paul insisted that he is alive. That's what all true followers of Christ also believe, of course. But as regarded Roman law, these were theological issues of no concern whatsoever. And Festus admitted that he was surprised that the charges did not match the penalty that he was being asked to render. They want this man dead. And basically, he's looking at it over what? Okay? And so, like the tribune who first arrested Paul, Festus could not understand why the Jews wanted to kill a man over such things. As he himself continued, "Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. And then Agrippa said to Festus, 'I would like to hear the man myself.' 'Tomorrow,' said he, 'you will hear him.'" So now the stage is set for Paul's fifth and final defense in Palestine. So five hearings, parallel to the five hearings of Christ. And like Christ, Paul is being passed from procurator to Herodian king. You remember that. And even though Festus represented the greater power of Rome, he essentially allowed Agrippa to conduct the hearing the next day, as we'll see next week. But in verse 23, it says, "So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in." Now, the irony of this has been pointed out. the fact that all of this pomp and the ceremony and the spectacle surrounding these great people, yet the only reason that history remembers them today is because they once crossed paths with this lowly Jewish prisoner. Otherwise, these people and their glory would have been just another footnote in history. It's the only reason why we're mentioning them today, right? The center of history, at least this history, is the Apostle Paul, not these great figures and all their pomp and ceremony. But in that day, of course, such a future could not have been imagined. And so here in great ceremony, Agrippa and Bernice lead this regal procession, followed by the military and the civic leaders, and they go into the great hall of Herod's old palace, and there he took his seat next to the imperial governor. And the prisoner was brought in and stood before the assembled audience. Verse 24. And Festus said, and he's announcing this to the crowd, King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. So once again, Providence had repeated the verdict pronounced by Pontius Pilate, almost exactly. We look at Luke chapter 24, beginning at verse 13. It says, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. After examining him before you, behold, I do not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. And then Pilate continued, neither did Herod. Finding nothing deserving death has been done by him. The same thing's going to happen next week. So there's the parallel that Luke begins to describe. The parallel between Christ and the trials that he goes through and the Apostle Paul. And the fact that in both cases, it's the Romans who find him not guilty of anything. And yet the Jews demand that he be put to death. And so now, with Paul brought before the assembled dignitaries, Festus announced the immediate reason why the session has been called and why the prisoner was going to be heard, and that was to define what Festus is going to write in his report to the emperor. Luke writes, and he himself appealed to the emperor, I have decided to go ahead and send him, but I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. And so that's the real reason why he's there. And as we said earlier, denying Paul's appeal to Caesar would have had risk for Festus. He would have had to explain why he wasn't allowing it. But also, on the other hand, sending Paul to the emperor was also carrying some risk because sending a citizen under arrest without clear justification would have called into question his own competence as governor. Why are you sending this man? You should have been able to handle this on your own. There's no charges here worthy of being heard by the imperial court. And so that's the real reason why the Apostle Paul is going to be allowed to preach the gospel before a king in next week's chapter, just as it was foretold by the Holy Spirit in chapter 9. Now, with some trepidation, a few closing thoughts about providence that came to my mind in reading this. I'm reminded that Calvin wrote that contemplating God's sovereignty, his decree over everything that happens, it's like entering a maze, and we are quickly lost and bewildered in that maze. What we know for certain is that the scriptures insist, point blank, there is a fixed script to history.
That's right.
As Isaiah wrote in chapter 14 of Isaiah, this is the plan determined for the whole world. This is the hand stretched out over all nations. The Lord God governs all. And every day, innumerable causes and effects are being orchestrated according to his decree as that decree fulfills his purpose. Now, several times we've used the analogy of dominoes, but of course that is simplistic, as all analogies are. God doesn't simply knock over a domino and watch the results. In that analogy, he also controls the gravity. He holds the molecules of the dominoes together. Everything about that illustration is controlled by God. And each domino has effect on an almost infinite number of other dominoes, also being controlled by God. But as I said, mostly it fails because God doesn't look through the quarter of time to know the future of dominoes. He knows the future of the dominoes because he knows what he himself determined what each domino is going to do and where it's going to fall. And that's why the Westminster Shorter Catechism defines God's decree as his eternal purpose according to the counsel of his will, whereby he has foreordained whatsoever comes to pass. I said all of that because there are so many threads in each person's life that saying a person lived for a single impact upon history would be, of course, simplistic. And yet all of history is subservient, serves redemptive history. And as John Flavel once said, God's providence, like Hebrew letters, is best read in reverse. So when we look back on it, we may not know what God is intending for tomorrow, but we can look back upon yesterday and see what God intended.
That's right.
So remember, Hebrew is read right to left, so we read it in reverse. That's the way we can judge God's providence, what actually happened. So it's too simplistic to say that we can glean the only reason that Porcius Festus lived. But in light of providence and redemptive history, we can glean the most important reason that Festus lived and died. The reason we know so little about Festus is that he died after being in office only a couple of years. And he was succeeded in office by inept, corrupt, brutal men who plunged Judea back into chaos, and she resumed her path towards destruction. So what we know is that God had decreed both judgment against Israel and also that Paul would arrive safely in Rome. Now, there were infinite ways, infinite means for this to happen. I mean, for example, he could have restrained the heart of Felix, allowed Paul to go. He could have suspended the hatred of the Jews. But usually God typically works within the nature of a thing. To suspend their hatred would have been unnatural. Of course, the greatest exception to that is salvation itself, which by definition is the changing of the thing's nature. But the point being that by reading the life and death of Festus in light of redemptive history, is it not justified to say that he lived in order to bring a brief moment of prudent rule to preserve the life of Paul and send him to Rome, and that he died to prevent that prudent rule from altering the path of destruction that Christ had prophesied for Judea? And how significant, then, is the symbolism that when Festus died and Judea was left without a governor, the Jews took that as an opportunity to murder James, the brother of Jesus. And so the road to the judgment of 70 AD was resumed, literally, with vengeance.